Well, welcome to some new faces this morning. I'd like to just backtrack just two little things from yesterday, partly because of what Mr. Pitcher, not here this morning, is planning to do later, and partly because of the people who were not here yesterday. Two things to sort of fill in. There are two pictures of God that correspond to two major segments within the first part of the creation stories. The first chapter portrays God as the great commander. And there's a chain of command in that portrait. God orders the whole creation as though he stood at a distance and with the authority of a general says, let there be these things, and everything is put in its proper place, and then he says, we need certain things to govern certain places. The stars we need to govern the sky, and the sun to govern the day and the night, and man we need to govern the earth, and to rule over it, and to be in command over it. And it says, to subdue it. And there is implied in that a kind of power that man has to control. It's a derived power from the almighty power of God. And in this chain of power, we have a whole concept of man's relationship to God as the obedient one under the commander kind of thing. And if there is to be order, it is to be spelled out in terms of obedience. The second picture of God, which comes in the other chapters, the chapters 2 and then the following chapters, is a very different picture of God. Not God the commander, but God the agonizing partner. The one who is right there in the middle of things, as it were, experimenting in the process of creation, of how things will work out. And one of the texts that I didn't discuss very much is the text that comes just a little bit later in the same picture of God. It's a text at the beginning of the story of the flood. Well, finally, when God had made the world and everything was now working, or so he thought, man became violently rebellious against God, and God goes into agony over the situation. And it says that he has great pains of soul. The best way to translate the words that are there. And the picture of God, who is the God who suffers, as it were, suffers along with the whole process of learning how to create, is a very different kind of picture. It's as though you are with God as he learns how to create man and woman and the animals and finds out what works and what doesn't work and what ways to remedy the thing if it doesn't quite work. It almost appears like God has severe limitations, and yet as you listen to it, you feel very close to the picture of Jesus Christ, the suffering God, in that other portrait of God. These two pictures stand side by side, somewhat in tension, and yet in some ways complementary. It's very important to recognize this picture of God, who is right there, like any other person, as it were, working his way through the steps of creating relationships, creating people, creating life. One other little note in what we did yesterday, apart from the two pictures of God, was the concept that man is tied to the ground in this second picture, that man is part of the earth, and that there's a repeated play on words between the ground, which is called Adama, the feminine, Mother Earth kind of thing, and Adam, which is man. In a sense, man comes from the feminine right from the outset. Man comes from the ground. And Adama really means the brown earth. And if there's any sense of color involved, Adam is not white. The same word for brown is the same word as Adam, but with one minor change in the letters. They are related words. If Adam is anything, he is the brown earth. And in order to sort of capture that, I had a little problem with CPH on that. I wanted to portray the first man in the color that is implied in the biblical text. And all we came to a compromise, and we have him this is the way the text reads in the Purple Puzzle. For those of you who don't know, a lot of the theology that we talk about on this level is done rather subtly under the nose of President Preuss in the Purple Puzzle Tree, for those of you who don't know about this children's thing. And my theology is hidden in the stories of this. And this is the story that we had yesterday, just a little section of it, so you get a feel of it. You'll have to learn to be children, but remember the theology. God sat on the ground and for a long, long time, for he hadn't really found someone to laugh and talk with, to sing and play and walk with, and tell the real good news he had on his mind. God sat on the ground and he looked and he frowned on a very sunny day. God sat on the ground and he held in his hand a lump of dirt and a lump of clay. And strange to say, the clay was almost red. So God squashed and squeezed and squoogled it until he made a head. God sat on the ground and he held in his hand another lump of clay. Strange to say, he took no paste or glue. He squashed and squeezed and squoogled it until he made a boy like you and you. Now that boy's name was Adam, an old, old word for brown or red, the color of the clay, you see, that God had used to make the first red man. And if you cut your finger, you'll see. You're probably just as red inside as he. Now, on a lot of the more serious, same idea is picked up when we did Mature Adults Only in a song that is, in a cry that is by a black boy called Willie. And the idea that in some real way there's a bond between man, the black man, and the ground and all men is implied in this cry. And it was always cried rather forcefully, so by some fine black actors when we did the show. And the song is sung by a very fine black friend of ours. And I'd like to read just a little of it, and especially the key lines at the end, which make the connection, and which are rather significant, I think, for helping us to understand, maybe as a preface to what Al's going to do a little bit later. Can you see that broken glass? Can you see that tiny crib burnt by the flames? Can you see that twisted doll with its face crushed beneath a fireman's boot? Can you? And can you see that large rat wander through the rubble unafraid? Does it mean anything to you? You who drive through my street unafraid behind the locked doors of your car. Well, it would if people were blaming you for the rats and the riots and the rubbish of the city. It would if they called you a pig and a nigger. It would if your white friends turned on you and said, you aren't one of us anymore. You can't sleep over at our house. You can't eat dinner with us. You can't drink the blood of Christ with us. You belong in the dirt. And the dirt makes us equal. God took some dirt, they say. Some rich brown clay, some cold black earth. And molded a man from the ground. A man that must have been the color of the ground. And God wanted Adam that way. Rich and brown and black, and that was good, he said. Why won't you accept me that way? I'm not to blame for the evils of the city any more or less than you. Why do you reject me? Because God made me more like Adam and blacker than you. So that was yesterday's picture, man, the ground. Today's picture is to look a step further in Genesis 2 and 3 to, as it were, the completion of the creation story, and particularly the function and the role of the woman in the creation story. If you have, those of you who have your Bibles, if you look now to the point where a woman is about to be created, which is where we stopped yesterday, you will discover a very interesting thing right at the outset. It says that God, the man, gave names to all the cattle and all the birds of the air and to every beast of the field. And then comes the comment which leads up to the creation of the woman. And the comment is, but for the man, there was not found a helper fit for him. There are several things to remember. First of all, when it says there's something like in the passive, there was not found. In the Bible, you use that passive, that third person, there was not found, to be equivalent to a way of saying God could not find. You are back to the same picture that we had before of God searching among the animals, as it were, God searching for all of the things that he had made to see whether or not the creation was complete. There was not found. God had not found amongst all that was made something suitable to be the complement for man. The second thing that's in that text is a key word there called helper. And one of the problems is to translate that word. And you have to ask the question, what is the Hebrew word that you are translating by the word helper? And the difficulty there is that that word has two different roots and is translated two different ways in different parts of the Bible. In some places it's translated to help. God is my refuge and my help. That's the same word. But there are other places where that word does not mean help, but it implies another dimension, namely power. And if you simply use the word help as we tend to do in our tradition, you tend to imply some kind of secondary character to the woman by virtue of that particular English translation of what is a much stronger Hebrew word. When you say to God be my help, that means my rescue, my salvation, that which will fulfill me or deliver me or protect me. It implies power and a lot of other things. And the second meaning of that root is clearly one of power. Now, to suddenly keep that English word in there with the kind of content that we have in any new translation is to lose track, I think, of what's there in the original. That for man to have power, in the sense of to be fulfilled, to be that the creation might be complete, woman was the ultimate. That which was necessary to complete the plan. Woman was the climax to the creation plan in this text. In the other text, mankind in general. Here the whole thing leads up to that one last piece that's missing. As God searches through everything to put it all in place, the garden, the trees, everything is there, but one thing is missing. And that is the power that will bring life and relationships and everything else.
The New English is partner.
Partner is good. I don't know of a good word to translate it because there are these two nuances. The one is deliverance and the other one is power that is involved in the word. And partner is all right. It almost sounds like a contract thing. And it's not quite the right word. I haven't found an English translation. I can't say savior. That has other connotations. But there's something of that in a sense in it. You know, if God's creation is to be fulfilled, it is essential that this part be put in its place at the end of the whole sequence.
Norm, is there any indication that man was an asexual being at that time?
That's
God
a good question.
Is this thing that he created the sexuality of man and woman, or is there an indication that man was fully sexual and then he created woman?
There are two implications from that question. One is that by virtue of man trying to find relationships with all the animals, you have possibly in the background a hint that the Israelite rejected all forms of bestiality as being evil. In fact, that's very evident in the law codes. The second thing is that many, many peoples in the ancient worlds and in primitive societies had the concept that the first man was bisexual. And that the first individual, he was called man or woman, but the first individual was bisexual, and that In the earliest version of the story, some people would argue that that's the case here. Whether that's true or not, I don't think you can tell from this text. But it's a common tradition amongst people that the first creature was both male and female, and in order for there to be progeny, the deity divided them. And really what you have here is in this story is not that woman is made out of the ground, but the dividing of the first creature into two parts. See? So that now you have man and woman instead of simply the earth creature. So there's the possibility that in the background that idea is there. I have not fostered it particularly. I think it's for our society, the idea that the first creature was both male and female is rather an awkward concept. And some Greek people have it, but I find it mostly in Oceanic peoples and other primitive societies around the world. It's not at all confined to any one society by any means.
You know, genetically there's something to back that up. In the embryo, all embryos, the female first and the male develops quite late.
Yeah. And most societies have, by the way, the idea that the earliest materials, whether it's the chaos waters or the primal egg, are really the feminine from which the masculine is derived. This is striking, that the figure is portrayed more as masculine and then the feminine is taken from the masculine. So this dividing of the first person, the first creature, is not at all a unique idea. But it is striking that he didn't simply take more clay and make another one. He makes the final part out of the first creature. That's very obvious from the text. And that's really what the rib business is all about, and that's what comes up next, is the taking of the rib is a way of saying, symbolically, that man and woman come out from each other, or that woman is taken, it comes from man. It says nothing about the question of secondary character. It says something about the very fact that man and woman are part and parcel of the same creature, the same first being that God made for the world. And they are bound together in that sense, and they are tied together because they are the same. And that explains the little note that follows, namely, man says, this is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. That therefore she is different from the animals where the first effort at relating took place. Now I think you have to remember also that in the ancient world, they have a number of stories about how the first man was really a creature out in the woods in the wilds. And there's a story in the Gilgamesh epic from Babylon where this man, creature almost, is called Enkidu, and he lives with all of the animals, just like a primal man, a first man. And he lives with the animals, have a perfect relationship with all the animals, can runs with them, runs with the gazelle, can do all those things. And then Gilgamesh, the hero of the story, finds him out there. And the way was, how was this man to become civilized? How was he to get wisdom and knowledge and all the rest of it? And so he meets this courtesan, this lover. And she, by virtue of the sexual activity, becomes the supreme teacher of what it means to become human, what it means to become sophisticated or civilized. And he makes love with her for a week or whatever it is. I don't remember the exact time. But anyway, it was enough to humanize him, so the text goes. And he becomes like the gods, it says. And he becomes knowing, has knowledge of man and woman and of the city and all the rest of it. And then after he's had his fill, he goes back to the country again, to the gazelles and the rams and everything else that are out in the field, and they absolutely reject him because he is no longer one with them. He is no longer in harmony with nature in the same way that he was before. And in a sense, there's something of the same thing in this story with a man who was one with nature by virtue now of the oneness with his wife separates from that and becomes one with her. And through the act that follows, then of course alienation further from the world of nature takes place. Those are good questions. Yes?
Well, There's something in there, too, of an apologetic character of the writer. There is a sense of, in the midst of the other divisions around which the evil people were living, to affirm the relationship they had to God, and even the same thing that the first chapter against it, as being sort of the seven-day sort of a faith, the seven-day cycle that they have of God in their worship, as opposed to physical religion. And here, too, the unique relationship of man to their God, as opposed to the other religions around them, which is always one of trying to placate and a fear of God, a very real relationship of man to God.
I suppose the most important part of the analogy against the Near Eastern world that is here is the picture over against the gods of Canaan, which I will say more about in Genesis 3, but right at the outset, all of the gods of Israel's neighbors were sexual beings. And in a sense, everything came into being, whether it's the trees or the life or all of nature, came into being in some way by virtue of sexual activity. We have still have a hangover of the sense that sexual activity is somehow or another wrong. There's something inherently negative about it. And most peoples, primitive myths and peoples, have no problem with that. Rather, it is the normal way of creating through procreating. And if the gods are, in any sense, powerful creatures who can create, they will procreate the universe. And so many, many peoples have this basic concept. But Israel did have a striking difference at this point. And the moment you have only one God as a primary way of understanding God, you have eliminated the whole concept of creation by procreation as a possibility. And so, in a certain sense, it's a unique thing that only mankind and the animal world create through procreation. And what happens then is that God creates man and woman here with the power to do, in a certain sense, what in other, their neighbors' religions, the gods did, namely to begin the process of procreation. God has created everything like a potter molding here. That's the way he made the world in this story. And there is a polemic. Now, if you finally go to the point where Eve has a child, chapter 4, verse 1, what does it say? Adam knew his wife, Eve, and she says, I have, and there's a verb there, the translation in the text is gotten. That word can mean create. It's the same word that is used of the Canaanite gods creating or procreating things. The very same word is used in Canaan. And it implies the kind of power that she claims to have now begun the process of creation, of having progeny, and that procreation and creation flow together in this kind of language. But it is clearly distinct in Israel that God, however, is not the one who procreates things any longer. That concept is passed. It's a striking break with almost all other religions, the idea that God creates outside of the procreative process. He creates either by word or by hand. Those are the two major vehicles that are spelled out here. Well, I better stop letting the questions run and take a 10 minutes or 15 to say a couple of key things in addition concerning the picture of the creation of woman here. I mentioned one, the concept of the helper, and I mentioned also the particular nuance of meaning that is connected with the idea of being taken from the rib. In addition, there's a text here that says, now she will be called woman because she came out of man. The point of that particular reference is that there's a word play between man and woman. The two words are not etymologically connected, but it's a popular way of connecting the two and making it clear that there was the dividing of the first creature into two parts. That in a certain sense, the first creature is not really completely a human being, if you will. He remains asexual, if you like, until the two are created. And that's the ultimate point of creation, to make the sexual dimension, to make the pairing, to make that possible. That is the climax to creation. And then verse 24 really leads it all to the point, not simply of the climax to creation, but to the possibility of a sense of identity and a fulfillment. That a man and a woman, therefore, will leave the father and the mother. That's the last point in the creation story. The departure from the womb is the ultimate. And those mothers and those parents who would not let or like their child to leave and unite and to really become independent of the parent, in a certain sense, are clutching at things that are contrary to the pattern of creation. That the whole plan of creation ultimately moves to the point where a man or a woman becomes truly who they are through the ultimate act of union with some other man or woman. And the two cleave together and become one flesh. There's a lot of argument about what the word one flesh means here. Some have said it means that they will produce a child, which is the common property of both of them. In my opinion, one flesh is the way in saying in Hebrew, like one God and other things, both one combination, union, and two, communion, and three, in a certain sense, fulfillment. Communion is perhaps as good a word as any to describe it, but there is fulfillment in the process of the union of man and woman. And the two are bound together. There's nothing that is implied in this text that is in the order of things the way they are here that suggests that the woman is somehow or another inferior or secondary to the man. Just the contrary. She is one, the necessary complement and fulfillment of the creation plan. And two, in order that there might be the total glory of the plan of salvation, of creation, they are to be united and become one flesh. That is the order of creation that this writer says is basic. Now I want to say one other thing. I'm going to leap a little bit in order to fulfill this sequence and now come back to chapter 3. Woman's role in the fall is essentially the one who determines destinies. To understand the role of woman in Genesis, one has to recognize that Eve and Sarah and Rebecca and certain other women, but mostly those, are the ones, even Rachel, who determine destinies. We tend to think of a heroine in terms of a good girl, instead of the way she was understood in the ancient world, as the one who determines fate in some way. And these three figures, above all, Eve and Sarah and Rebecca, determine the course, one, of creation and man's relationship with creation, and two, determine the course, in a certain sense, of the plan of salvation. From one point of view, they do it. And what's important here is to recognize that Eve is the one, ultimately, through whom wisdom and skill and all of those things are dreamt of as possible. She becomes the vehicle for those kind of dreams and those kind of possibilities, those kind of reachings out to be like God. Albeit they were rebellious, they were nevertheless those acts which determined the course and the fate of relationships. She becomes the primary figure in that sense. She is not the one who has the primary guilt, which is the way it is often spelled out. The guilt is falls on all three parties, the man and the woman and the snake. And man's guilt is that he listened, it said, to the woman. He played the role of the one who simply went along instead of recognizing and saying no or whatever he should have said. The guilt is equally on all parties. The act which is the primary act, of course, is through the woman. And I think that needs to be said. But it does not say that in some sense the guilt is greater on the one part than the other. The second thing that's very important in this to understand before you try and extrapolate from the text too much theology is that the result of the act of sin and the determining of destiny by the woman's act is that three curses are placed. Curses are placed on, actually four curses. The curses are placed on the snake, and on the relationship between man and woman, and on the relationship between man and the ground. And those three curses are curses that are introduced as a result of the sin, of the fall. Now keep in mind, they are curses. They are not part of the order of the way things were first made. And it is part of the plan of the text of Genesis, if you look at it from this point on, to show what the curses did and how God began the plan of trying to counter the curses through Abraham. And ultimately, if you read the New Testament in Galatians 3, it is the task of Jesus Christ to nullify the curses and to bring about the order of things in creation the way they were, so that there are neither male nor female, and so forth, so at the end of Galatians. If you go back to this text and say, all right, what is the nature of the curse? The curse is explicitly, in the case of the man and woman, that she will have agony in childbirth, but nevertheless she does have childbirth. She is not put to death. We'll come back to the question of what death means in all of this tomorrow. And second, she shall have desire for her husband because he shall, in verse 16, rule over you, it says. Now the ruling of the man over the woman, of course, is part of the cultural context out of which this writer lived. That was a common factor in the ancient Near Eastern world, but not all of the ancient Near Eastern world. The community out of which Rebecca came was not a community which had a patriarchy, but as far as we can tell, a matriarchy. And you have matriarchal societies outside of the ancient Near Eastern world. You have them in Africa and various places. Not automatic that you look at all cultures and find that it's male-dominated. It was generally true of the Near Eastern world. But what's so striking about this writer is that he says that that domination is not integral to the way things were in Eden, but is due to the curse that has been introduced into the universe, and that it is part of the plan of salvation of God to overcome that curse. And it is the implication in the New Testament that that curse can be removed and is being removed. Now, all such curses are being removed in the process of redeeming a creation by the work of Jesus Christ. Now, if we keep that in mind and keep going and say, what is the picture of the curses and how is this being negated? You get another picture of people like Rebecca or Sarah, whose actions under the curse nevertheless are forces which bring about life and salvation to the rest of the world, or to the community, whatever it happens to be. At the end of this story, in chapter verse 20, what's important is that the woman is given the name. She is called Eve. By the way, they are not called Adam and Eve in the first part of their story. They're just called the man and the woman. It's only at the end that they get these names. And the name is that she is the mother of all that is alive. She gets the title of being the progenitor of the universe. And in that sense, she is a determiner of destinies in a second way. So if you will, the picture of the woman here is not simply one that God has fixed in order that she will always have to be somehow or another playing second fiddle, but rather the way things ought to be is one thing. The way things have been caused to be because of sin on the earth is another. And it is part of the process of those who are sons of God to overcome those curses and bring about the order of things the way God would have them. Our time is starting to run. I better allow a couple of minutes for questions. Here. Questions? Somebody has.
In what way did you say that Eve is the
There's a very interesting reference. The reason why they want to take of the tree of knowledge of good and evil is threefold. There are three reasons why they want to take of that tree. And now I want to talk more about the fall tomorrow and the full implications of that story. But there are three things there. One is that it looked good to eat. There was something desirable about it and something tasty. A very simple kind of thing. The second thing is that it says that the tree was a delight to the eye. There was something aesthetic, there was something, and the implication may be there very well, even sexual. That particular word reaches out to another dimension of man. But there's a third dimension of man's psyche to which it also appealed, namely that it may make him wise. And the word that is there, wise, implies the skill and the ability to do things because you have the know-how. It's not simply that you have a very sharp intellect, but all of those kind of things. And so the tree is not merely a kind of bland thing where you take it and you do act in rebellion. It is part of the kind of processes of life that you and I might know about, where through the ordinary processes of some things that we might think are good to eat or delightful or could make us wise, those kind of things, everyday kind of things, were the vehicle that were put into the eyes of the woman as the way whereby she could somehow get to be and have the wisdom, the abilities, the skills of God, you see, so that she could control, if you will, if she could make the way that God did. And it was not so much that the things, it was good to be wise, but that there was this extra little footnote there that by doing that you will be like God, and you will go beyond that which would have been legitimate for her to have in terms of skill and wisdom. It certainly is in there.
I like this little phrase. I was wondering if there's any special significance more than just what it says. In the temptation, the fact that nobody accepted the blame, all it
ever
is.
Everybody passes the buck.
Everybody passes it. You gave the woman to me, it's your fault.
Yeah, right.
That's not my fault, she gave it to me.
Yeah, I was going to.
The serpent did it.
Pick that up tomorrow. Adam comes to God and says, "Hey God, we got a problem. The woman over here, you know." And, there's a lot of there's a certain amount of chauvinism right there.
Norm, have you read C.S. Lewis's Lives of the Saints? Yeah. Theology about that.
No, I haven't.
I think it was in his book Paralandra.
Yeah, I know the book, but
John
I don't. Yes.
In that series. But in there, it's the serpent tempting the woman by saying that, let's see if I can put it right, that if she attains the knowledge of God through this tree, that she'll be more of a companion to God, that she'd be more on his level, and it was through love of God that she was willing to sacrifice to be disobedient. In order to become closer to him, be more like him. It's kind of an interesting
Yes, it's a nice twist, yes. Well, what I would like to do tomorrow is to take a look at the fall story and ask the question about where we fit in the picture of the understanding of death and life, and in what sense the grace of God comes through in the story about death and the curse and all the rest of it. Because this story is not merely a story about the curse. It's above all a story about how God, as it were, has to handle the problem of man who keeps doing these things wrong. And every time man does something wrong, God has to counterbalance it with something that overcomes it. And it's this God who is right there working to kind of overcome the picture of man, the activities of man. And we'll work into that a little bit tomorrow as a kind of fulfillment, so we move to the message of the grace in the midst of death, the blessing in the midst of the curse, and how that all ties it all together a little bit tomorrow.
Norm, is there an implication in Genesis that God originally planned man would live forever, not know death?
The picture is very clear that, as we mentioned yesterday, the tree of life is put there in the garden as one of those things that expresses in a symbolic way that man has a yearning for something more than simply clay. But his clayness is clearly the basic characteristic. Anything that is, in terms of eternal life, living beyond that, is not inherent within him, but something that must be a gift from God, something that is a divine gift from the outside. And that is very explicit too in Paul. The heavenly body that he talks about in 1 Corinthians 15 is not something that we have automatically. It is not something that we will automatically live forever when we die. The living forever, the gift of eternal life, the transformation that we have of this body into something that is more, in some way or another, in Paul's language, is a gift from God from the outside. It is not inherent that I will live forever. And the picture of the Old Testament is that man is like any animal, he will return to the dust from which he came. But the possibility out there of another dimension to man's existence that God can give him has always been kind of in the background there. But what's important is that we don't fall into the trap of being Greeks who said that there was an immortal something that is inside of me that will automatically be immortal no matter what happens to this body. For the Old Testament picture, man is made out of the clay and he is not a creature. He is not man if he is not breath and dust, if he is not a body. Without a body, you are nothing in Old Testament language. And it is important to see that if there is any kind of future for man, in some way he has to be conceived of in terms of having a total character. And that means a body in some form. And Paul, even in his picture of the new man and the heavenly man that we would be, has a heavenly body, he calls it. But without a body, we are nothing. Without having been formed, we are nothing. And that's Old Testament language. And that's really the background of the New Testament picture. To start talking about this little end of blue flame thing inside of you is really a Greek thought. This little soul thing is not Old Testament language. This is Old Testament language. You are animated dust. And it is as dust that all the gifts of God in a certain sense are even greater. Because without that gift from the outside, you don't have life here and you don't have life beyond here at any point. And that dream is there, though. Not played up in the Old Testament, though. It's sort of left in the background. In the New Testament, it is being developed. All right. See you tomorrow.